It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For many colleges and universities, fall classes will begin in the upcoming weeks. And despite concerns about COVID-19, many are moving students back to campus. But how are local institutions dealing with the return to campus during a global pandemic? Sarah Schneider is 90.5 WESA's education reporter. Sarah, is there any kind of overarching guidance for how colleges and universities are supposed to resume classes, whether it's on campus or online?
So there's a lot of local control right now, and universities are being asked to make the best decision for their communities based on case numbers and hospitalizations of COVID-19 in their area. But that means there's not a lot of consistency in the state, and it's university by university. They're all doing this a little bit differently.
Have you noticed any similarities as you've looked at the different plans that universities and colleges are putting together about reopening?
So all of the universities in the city of Pittsburgh are offering some sort of hybrid model. That means there's going to be both in-person and online instruction. So in the next few weeks, we should expect to see a lot of people return to the city. But some universities like Pitt, Pitt is the largest, the University of Pittsburgh is the largest university in terms of enrollment in our region. And they're requiring students to quarantine when they arrive, though other universities are only strongly suggesting it. So again, it's not consistent, and there's still a lot of confusion.
So we're talking individual universities, but what about the state-owned universities under the supervision of one chancellor? Is it one plan fits all 14, or is it up to each?
It's up to each. The state-owned university system has said that each university must build its plan based on what it believes is best for its situation and must be prepared to change course if new information becomes known or understood. Unique example is Indiana University of Pennsylvania is close to us, and it's the largest state-owned university in our region, and it's the ninth of the 14 state-owned universities to shift from this mostly in-person model to mostly online. Only a third of students have been invited back to return to campus because of the rising number of cases and hospitalizations.
A third have been invited back, mm-hmm. so they had to get that invitation before they could actually step on campus?
Right. So only certain groups are invited back. Freshmen, first-year students, graduate students, international students, and students with specialized needs. So maybe they require in-person learning and online was very difficult for them. All other students will be online. And so this will, again, reduce the number to about a third of students on campus. And that's because, Indiana County has far fewer cases of COVID-19 than Allegheny County. Though the fear now is that you'll have students traveling from wherever they were living. So if they were living in Allegheny County and now they're going to Indiana, the numbers could increase there.
Have you heard anything from faculty or students about concerns they have about being together on campus?
Yeah, I've talked to a few students who have said they're trying to create a pod before they even arrive to campus. A pod meaning they're going to have certain friends that they're only going to interact with those friends, and that they're not going to go to in-person classes because of this fear. And those are oftentimes students who are at risk of contracting the coronavirus. And I think we'll see a lot of that. And again, that's really just going to change the social aspect of college.
Finally, Sarah, we're hearing you've indicated that plans for the restart are still evolving. Do they have plans for the possibility that they're going to have to shut down again in case a big second wave hits?
Every university in our region has a plan to be flexible if that happens. And so that's why so many universities are opting for this hybrid model, so that they're already starting this online learning in case they have to go back to that fully in the fall.
Sarah Schneider is 90.5 WESA's education reporter. Sarah, thanks so much for being here.
Of course. Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh school board members voted unanimously to have the district teach students remotely for the first 9 weeks of the school year. Teachers are getting online education training and in turn will train their students on the technology. However, nearly three quarters of the thousands of computers the district has purchased are backordered. The second largest school district in the county, North Allegheny, has announced that classes will begin September 8th, and students will have the option of learning in classroom, online, or a combination. More than one-third of parents across the country say they're not comfortable sending their kids back, according to new data from Pittsburgh-based research firm Civic Science. But about half of the parents surveyed say they want schools open for in-person learning. Casey Taylor helps analyze consumer trends for Civic Science. Casey, it seems that income is a dividing line among people that you surveyed. Your report says that households making less than $50,000 a year are much more likely than higher earners to be not comfortable sending their kids back. Any reasons for that?
I think there is one, an understanding perhaps among lower income consumers about the seriousness of the pandemic that maybe has avoided in some ways larger swaths of more affluent folks in the population. But I think the other thing we're seeing there is related to the work status of both of those groups of people, which is there's a significantly higher proportion of people in that under $50,000 range that have already lost their job, right? So when you ignore the likelihood of exposure and then potentially the likelihood of knowing the consequences and the dangers of the pandemic among that group, there's also a higher likelihood that these are people that are not having to go back to work. I think a lot of the things that we see in our data are that the more affluent groups are more likely to want to send their kids to school because they're still working, and balancing work with online education for your kids is its own challenge when you don't have childcare avenues available to you for a variety of reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Mostly driven by the pandemic and closures and things like that.
How much is it that schools in poorer neighborhoods aren't equipped to deal with COVID-related issues, whether it's distancing, ventilation, temperature checks?
I mean, I'm sure that has a lot to do with it, but if anything, that might be more of a subconscious indicator. I think the fact that, again, if you have less money and you're in one of those poor neighborhoods, it means there's a higher likelihood that there's large swaths of people that have either been exposed directly or know people that have been exposed, which then kind of makes you just a little bit more cautious and a little bit more concerned.
Mm-hmm. In your survey, how do the parents feel about the quality of learning in school versus online?
What we've ultimately found is the concern looks a little bit less about like the actual quality of education being received online versus the capacity for parents to feel like they're doing a good enough job. You know, for those parents that either don't have a job they're trying to juggle with their kids' education, you see slightly less concern, which again, I think is also feeding why some of the lower income segments tend to like be less comfortable sending their kids in person. I think it's also because they're more comfortable educating their kids at home because they have the time to do so. They don't have those distractions.
And lower income parents are more reluctant to send their kids back, even though those families might need many of the out-of-classroom services that schools provide, like free lunches, after-school programs. Your findings about income level correlate to race and the disproportionate incidence of COVID-19 among people of color.
Yes. We're seeing generally, I think it was somewhere around 57% of Black consumers say that they are not comfortable sending their kids back to school. And that compares to white consumers that say 31%. Ignorance is bliss in some capacity, right? And I think the more affluent classes during this pandemic, not to say that they've all been fine, right? I mean, there have been people impacted. There have been furloughs among high-profile positions at very large companies. But disproportionately, this is impacting lower-income consumers. And that's going to fuel that divide. You know, in a lot of ways, this pandemic has been a perfect storm to really bring those issues to light in a way that's very tangible.
Casey Taylor analyzes consumer trends for Pittsburgh-based research firm Civic Science. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. COVID-19 has disproportionately affected people of color in the U.S., with Black Americans experiencing mortality rates about 2.3 times as high as those of white Americans and Asian Americans. Black Americans are also reminded daily of racial inequities through the protests calling for justice. How can people of color deal with the ongoing racial trauma they experience? Neil Holmes is a Pittsburgh-based therapist who works with patients on racial trauma and mental health. Neil, let's start with, what is race-based trauma?
Race-based trauma is trauma that is infused or ensued with, I guess I could say, racial components. And that racial trauma that exists is in parallel with the trauma that the person has every day of their lives. For example, the trauma of being watched at by someone in a store when they're purchasing something, or the assumption that if one is in a particular neighborhood or surrounding, that just because they're a person of color, that they're meant to be in that space to cause harm or to do something of injustice. Those types of traumas, or many traumas, as you will, accumulate over time, and it causes a buildup of trauma in the human being. And so that's racial trauma.
Psychologists use the DSM-5 to diagnose patients, but experiences of racism might not easily fit into entries or checklists. So can diagnosing racial trauma be difficult?
It can definitely be difficult. I think diagnosing in general should be something that's done very sensitively. It is my role as a therapist when a client comes to me with any particular diagnosis, whether it's a diagnosis they had received prior to seeing me or a diagnosis that we're exploring, that we really have an in-depth conversation about, does that diagnosis actually fit you, and in what ways, how? And if there are parallels to that DSM-5 diagnosis that don't correlate because they're based upon Eurocentric standards or norms, then it's really important that we tease that out.
How about for people who belong to multiple marginalized groups? I'm thinking race, gender, sexuality. Do you see a compounding impact of all these traumas?
Absolutely. I myself, to speak personally, am a person who identifies as gay, and I'm very fortunate to work with, LGBTQIA plus clients in the community here in Pittsburgh. And the racial trauma that's infused with gender identity can be just as disparaging. So it's really important as a clinician that the work that I do with my clients, first of all, recognizes the duality of that identity and then calls to presence or to light the disparities that are there that we need to explore. So it's interesting, that approach, because sometimes we're working in tandem with both identities, and then sometimes we have to separate them and work with one first and then the other.
Neil, can people of color be themselves when they're out in public compared to who they are when they're among family, friends, people with shared experiences?
Kevin, it's very difficult. Often in my work, we talk about this sense of double consciousness that W. Du Bois used to talk about, of course, in his work, and a sense of duality that exists within people of color. The fact that they have to, quote unquote, put on a mask or represent themselves differently in like a corporate setting as opposed to when they're at home with their friends or their family. And this duality can be very disheartening over time, because as you can imagine, you're in one environment where you have to be, act, and exist a certain way. And when you go home, you're like, oh, I can finally let this mask off or take this off and let my guard down and just exist. And so for a lot of my clients, learning how to deal with that, how to take that off and put that on, and the unfairness of it, that they have to do this every day of their lives, can be certainly detrimental to their mental health.
Do you think that the events of recent months has helped people to seek maybe mental health services because of all the attention paid to racial injustice and maybe the painful memories, maybe even anger that might have been laid bare? Or are they even more hesitant to seek help and turn inward?
Yes, that's a great question, Kevin. I think I have definitely seen an increase in the number of clients that wish to engage in therapy. And when I speak to other colleagues in the field, I would believe that their comments would echo the same. I do, however, feel, though, that there's still a stigma in the Black community about engaging in mental health care.
That stigma, is it? Explain that. What is it? Is it an admission that I can't do it myself? And maybe a fear that other people will find out that I need some help, that I'm seeking some help.
I agree on both counts. That admission, as you can imagine, if one is dealing with a lot of racial inequality and disparities, and if you pile on top of that, for example, socioeconomic disparities, and they're able to make it every day, they may not be thriving to the extent in which they wish to thrive, but they're surviving. And if when they go through that cycle of survival and they're doing this day in and day out, they're like, okay, I'm here. So with that being said, one might not think I need to engage in therapy. Like, I'm making it every day. But I really try to stress that I want my clients to be empowered to live the life that they would like to live and to live it abundantly. And that it's really important that people know that they can do that.
For clients who are people of color, are there advantages to having a therapist, a counselor who's also a person of color?
There is an advantage, Kevin, to that. I think it's really important. We all, as human beings, want to see people who look like us or just have a general understanding. It may be, of course, all well being an assumption that maybe because they look like us that they have some shared commonality. But on a basic human level, as a person of color, I do have that, of course, that foundation to say I am like you in that sense because I am a person of color. So with that being said, my lived experience may be different from my client, but at least that is one basis and foundation that we can grow from. I think it's also important when I'm in that space with a client that we're both honest and open one another about our lived experiences to tear down any preconceived notions or biases that we both might have about each other's lived experiences. And to me, that's where the meat of the growth of therapy exists in collaborating together with my clients.
Neil, do you have white clients? And if so, what are you hearing from them concerning what's going on these days? Protests nationwide seeking justice.
I do. And I am also deeply, deeply enthralled and deeply, it's hard to find the word, but I'm encouraged, I guess you could say. I'm really encouraged by the work that I'm doing with the clients who are willing to explore their own white privilege and who are willing to really examine how they can make small changes within themselves to recognize their own biases, but also to challenge systems and realize the white privilege that they have in their life as a human being to change a system. So for most of my clients, we're talking about systemic work, like in their places of work, in their communities, in their churches, with their friend groups. Where can they break down those barriers of stigma and promote change within a system that will elevate other disenfranchised individuals in their lives?
Neil Holmes is a Pittsburgh-based therapist who works with patients on racial trauma and mental health. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Kevin, for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.